Sprouta is a global ecosystem of the very best experts and solution providers within people, performance, and culture. Companies like CultureAmp, VegaFactor, ExoWorks, and many more, ready to help you solve your toughest organizational challenges. Every strategic partner is chosen for their deep expertise within their fields and is supercharged by the Sprouta ecosystem. The result? You have a place to go for solutions that are holistic, impactful, and sustainable. No more fragmented transformation or trade-offs. Find solutions that are purpose-fit for your needs. Visit Sprouta.com to learn more. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Humanity Works podcast. I am Culture Craig, and so glad you've chosen to join us for today's episode with Peter Scutt, the co-founder and CEO of Mable. So Mable empowers people who are aging or those with a disability to customize their own care and support. In getting to know Peter and the organization that he's helped bring to life, I found myself incredibly inspired by not only the success that Mable has experienced as an organization, but also by the story behind how and why Peter decided to build this organization in the first place. Look, I'm fortunate to be able to have these conversations with amazing people doing incredible and inspiring things. And through this, I've found a common thread across so many of these conversations, which is build for you, build for the world. And what I mean by that is by solving a problem you feel the world needs and one that inspires you, we can have the greatest chance for both personal success while at the same time making a difference in the world. And this couldn't have been more prominent in learning about Peter's work. From what it appears, Peter could have easily continued on his path as a finance executive, but after supporting his parents through their aging journey and witnessing firsthand the care needed and the challenges associated with supporting them, it was clear that it could be better, and better for humans. So he decided to leverage his network and expertise to do just that, and Mable was born. It was also inspiring to learn that in the end, not only did he solve a problem for those requiring services, but also built a platform that provided economic opportunities to care providers as well. All of this because he saw a clear need and a path towards bringing Mable to life. So some additional things that we discussed in our conversation were the idea of profit for purpose, building a business that supports new ways of working, and rethinking the promise of tech-enabled gig economies that better support the humans involved.
So we could see that there were big challenges for not just my family and other people I knew, but more broadly that were systemic. When you looked at what some of those challenges were, we're sitting here saying, look, if we could build a platform that connected people with people in local communities, and we could put safeguards around those connections, we could really solve all the systemic problems that were being talked about, right? It was actually a really powerful, and I would say almost a profound moment where we went, wow, this is going to make a difference to so many lives and so many families and so many communities.
So if you're somebody who wants to build a career or a business designed to be fulfilling and impactful, then I think you're going to get a lot from this conversation. I know that I did. So with that, let's get to the conversation.
3, 2, 1.
Peter, thank you for coming and joining us today on the Sprouta Humanity Works podcast.
No, thank you, Craig. The pleasure is all mine. I think it's a great opportunity to share some of the work we've been doing and what we think about here at Mable.
So just for those listening, can you bring people up to speed on your professional journey, what's led you kind of to Mable?
When I was at university, I did a Bachelor of Commerce marketing major. You know, one of the things about marketing is it really gets you focused on human behavior. Also gets you thinking a lot about strategy. And it's those two things that I've sort of carried through my career because I then went into the finance sector. So I worked on trading floors for many, many years in investment banks, across foreign exchange, fixed income and derivatives. So far removed from the work I do today. I'd grown up in a country town in Wagga Wagga in Australia, then went to university in Sydney. I had the opportunity to move to New York and spent 8 years working in New York on trading floors there and became a partner of a global investment bank. As part of the leadership team there, we were looking at a lot at the impact of technology on capital markets businesses. And that sort of started to be a bit of a segue for me away from trading and sales. I actually founded the venture capital business for the bank in the States. And that was back in the late 90s. And that sort of took me out of trading and sales and gave me the opportunity to start meeting entrepreneurs that had a vision to leverage technology to empower people, to create efficiencies, to change outcomes, and that was sort of a segue into I guess, a much more entrepreneurial and venture journey for me. But, you know, after September 11th, I left New York about a year later and brought my young family back to Australia. It was really in 2013. As a family, we had older parents that were, you know, my dad was in his early 90s, mum was in her mid 80s. She had dementia. They were living still in Wagga, wanting to live in their own home and community, and had support through a government subsidized big provider. And it was really that personal experience of my family that really opened our eyes to the care and support sector and why I ended up, you know, founding Mabel.
Tell us about Mabel, why Mabel and what you're doing with Mabel.
Why Mabel really came from that personal experience. So, you know, my parents were very keen to remain living in their own home and community, which is true of most older people, right? It's the overwhelming preference. And it was clear they were going to need some support to be able to do that beyond what the family could provide. Although we had six children, only my older sister was in Wagga able to provide support. And, you know, the experience of my parents was that these large providers were really at the center of the marketplace, rostering workers to do jobs or tasks for them. And that would result in different people turning up every day, largely to help mum get ready in the morning. With dementia, you have a lot of anxiety, often fear. Familiarity becomes really important. So different people coming to the door every day was very difficult for my mother. And my father was a difficult old Englishman that didn't like people. And he found these strangers turning up every day something that didn't work for him either, right? So his view was, I don't need these strangers in our life. Your mum doesn't need them. Leave us alone. We'll cope on our own. And that was really going to be very challenging, right, without it being untenable for my sister to be able to manage work, manage mum and dad, manage her children. And so that was the sort of understanding that the way care at home worked for my parents really didn't serve my parents very well and probably didn't serve the people that were supporting them very well, that there was no opportunity for people that were supporting my parents to understand anything about them in terms of who they were, what their rich life history was. My dad served in the British Navy during World War II. He immigrated to Australia after the war. None of that context was relevant in that task-based rostered solution. And so it's really for me about, well, how do we create a different solution where mum and dad could choose people to support them from their community, people that they could build a relationship with, people that they could form trust with, people that could get to know them, that may have had common interests. You know, virtually the only people my dad wanted to speak to in his older age was people that grew up in England. He had this romantic notion of his childhood, right? And So that was the genesis of Mabel. And we thought that would actually disarm some of the resistance that my parents had from accepting support, because they're in control choosing people based on the things that are important to them. But it would also offer a completely different opportunity for the people that offered support, because they were being chosen. They were accepting the engagement. It was mutual choice to form a relationship around the care and support needs of my parents. And, you know, that was really where we started the vision.
I'm going to come back to a point here, but I'm curious, did it start as a side project, or did you make a clean break and say, there's a need here, I'm going to start building Mabel? And did you jump right in to build this platform or this connection tool?
So look, we jumped in pretty quickly, partly because a lot of my friends are my age and we're dealing with exactly the same issues. So when I started talking about, oh, my mum and dad and, you know, how are we going to keep them at home and what's happening, there was a shared story there with lots of others. Anybody that had experienced the aged care system felt it was, you know, ageist and paternalistic and not relationship-based, and their parents were struggling to even accept that they needed help because they didn't want to lose control of their lives. They thought big companies were going to take over. And so there was a common issue. And as we delved a little bit deeper, Australia uniquely had two productivity commission inquiries underway to look at the disability sector and the aged care sector. And there were lots of submissions to those inquiries that basically also validated the real systemic challenges of how we're going to care for an older population, how we were going to give them choice and control, how are we going to afford the aging system, how will we attract all the workforce needed. So we could see that there were big challenges for not just my family and other people I knew, but more broadly that were systemic. And when you looked at what some of those challenges were, we're sitting here saying, look, if we could build a platform that connected people with people in local communities, and we could put safeguards around those connections, we could really solve all the systemic problems that were being talked about, right? It was actually a really powerful, and I would say almost a profound moment where we went, wow, this is going to make a difference to so many lives and so many families and so many communities.
Yeah. And just for our listeners, where's Mabel today? Talk about, just summarize kind of that idea.
You know, we started with aged care in mind, and pretty quickly we had people with a disability discovering the platform because they were trying to tailor support around their unique view for their life. And we've essentially been more than doubling the platform year over year since inception. And although, you know, I think we operate it at a reasonable scale where we would have a community of about 20,000 people interacting on a monthly basis via the platform, split fairly equally between those that need support and those that offer support. When you think about the scale of, there's almost 4 million people in Australia that identify as having a disability out of a population of about 25 million, about 500,000 of those are directly eligible for a government funding program. There's probably 1 million Australians that receive some sort of government subsidy to get aged care at home. So the scale of the opportunity in Australia is very significant. So whilst we operate it at reasonable scale and we can see really strong growth, we feel we can continue this doubling of the size of the marketplace for quite some time. But also that we could really see a much greater tipping point, because I think the solution we offer is just so superior to the way care and support has been delivered historically.
Yeah. And how many employees is Mabel up to today?
We'd be approaching 250
Amazing.
Employees. And really that a lot of that scale has happened over the last 12 months as well.
Incredible. I've often mentioned this idea for most people, and what we're trying to accomplish in the world is build for yourself, build for the world. Find that need or that thing that you see needs to be done, that matters to you, build from that place, and then ultimately build for the world. And we talked about that, and you mentioned this idea of profit for purpose, which I thought was also interesting. And I think in this time and age when we're rethinking so much about our organizations, hearing that term, which I asked you if you coined it, you're like, I didn't coin it, but I had never heard that before. But I think that's a really important message, and I'd love to just hear more of your thoughts on this idea of profit for purpose.
When I heard the expression profit for purpose, I really latched onto that because I thought it really described what we were envisaging when we set up Mabel. The areas we operate in around aged care and disability support, you know, this is about human services to support people in communities everywhere, live independently, live a better life, live a life of their choosing. These are areas that touch nearly every family. Every family has their own story of an aging parent, grandparent, uncle, or a family member with a disability, or friends with family members with disability. And so the scale of what we're trying to do is far reaching. And yet when you look at some of the challenges society faces, where we've got a aging population, both in absolute terms, but also as a proportion of the population rapidly aging in Western economies, you also have really strong human rights movements around people with a disability having a right to live a good life, an ordinary life, to participate equally socially and economically. How we deliver a solution that meets everyone's individual needs, that live everywhere at a price point that government can afford, that taxpayers can afford, that empowers everyone and drives better outcomes, they're really challenging issues. And it's quite clear that government doesn't have the answer, right? Government's not going to solve this for us. Non-for-profits are not going to solve this for us. It's not a welfare challenge, right? It's a human rights challenge. It's a challenge of inclusion and people being able to live better and work better. And so I think, you know, how do you build a sustainable solution? I think it's around this profit for purpose model where they really go hand in hand, where to become sustainable, you need to be true to the purpose that we're trying to deliver. To deliver that purpose, we need to be sustainable. And so being able to think both through a lens of how we deliver a purpose, but also how we act commercially, and then we can actually start to solve these problems differently and start to solve them in sustainable ways that can be still delivering an outcome in decades to come.
Is this a model that you think can transcend into all industries and organizations, you know, in the same way of how to operate?
Yeah, I absolutely think it does. You know, for me as a personal journey, I come from a large family. I tend to think a lot of my career has been about listening and observing and trying to understand people. When we had this personal family experience, we could see how we could really make a difference to families and communities everywhere. But I've learned through starting Mabel, that's not unique. We are attracting at Mabel people with amazing commercial careers that have been extremely successful, but they're all looking at the lens of life saying, how do I get involved in something that I can be proud of, that I'm really making a tangible impact, that I feel my life's work is really worthwhile. So we're attracting amazing talent to Mabel because I think it's sort of well understood that for most organizations, connecting people to purpose is important. But when the purpose is so central to who we are and to the whole profit for purpose model, and also because people can so personally identify with it through their own family experiences, then you get people coming to Mabel for all the right reasons. But I think people want to work differently these days. And I would even say capital wants to work differently these days. You know, we've been able to raise quite a lot of funding over time from capital sources that want to make a difference, right? That also connect to our purpose, also have personal connection to what we're doing.
Yeah, it's inspiring to hear. And I think we see people talk a lot about newer generations of the workforce and this attachment to purpose. But, you know, it sounds like that's shifting across the board. People want to matter. They want to matter in their work, and there's different ways that they can connect to that. And I imagine Mabel is a very direct, to your point, so many people experience this at some level.
This sector has often been also dominated by people that come from a real community advocacy and family advocacy background, that they've really been wanting to change people's lives for decades, you know, to change the trajectory of the life of a person with a disability, to change the outcome for people that are older. And so what we're also doing is attracting people that understand that if I want to make sustainable change, it's not just about advocating, it's about building the solutions, right? And the building solutions require a commercial mindset as well. So we're bringing together people from both backgrounds where they're able to really marry those things at Mabel.
So switching gears a little bit was just an interesting, the policy piece, but also how that drives the work you do. And I learned through you about this National Disability Insurance Scheme. What I'm really driving towards, and I thought was so fascinating about this, is how it really shifted a model, how we approach things, and in some ways, almost a paradigm shift, and how you incorporated that move into your organization, and this move from welfare to empowerment, right? And I'd love to dig into that a little bit, but I'd love for to hear from you on how policy and for profit can, you know, merge and do good in the world.
Look, it's a great question, and look, in Australia, we've had bipartisan support for very significant social and funding reforms in both aged care and disability support. And when I mentioned there were Productivity Commission inquiries going on back in 2013, around 2011-12, those inquiries were happening in both aged care and disability. And it led to bipartisan support for these reforms in Australia. And really, you wouldn't get bipartisan support for such a major social reform unless there were powerful consumer movements driving it, right? So this has been people with a disability demanding something better for themselves, for example. And this is not just in Australia. This is worldwide, and has led to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of People with Disability, of which Australia is a signatory along with many other countries. But what I think the government, and this is both sides of politics have supported this through successive governments, is that a recognition that human rights are at the center of disability and aged care, that people deserve to have choice and control over their lives and the support they need to live a good life. And the reforms have really shifted the funding model from being a model where the funding was provided to big organizations to deliver care and support to people that were largely passive recipients of those services. So the business model for a lot of the big providers was to tender for government funding and comply with the regulation, and that was how the model worked, to let's shift that funding and put it in the hands of individuals, give them choice and control over the support they need to live their life, to respond to their needs and individual preferences. And that would drive not only better outcomes for the people with disability and older people that were requiring support to live independently and live well, but it would also force the marketplace to respond to those individual preferences. The people with disability now had purchasing power as consumers, as did people with, you know, that were aging. And so the marketplace now has to respond with a better value proposition, more innovative services, more responsive services, better value for money services. But what that's also meant is it's no longer a marketplace that's dominated by big organizations. It can also be a marketplace where sole traders and small businesses can thrive, because it's no longer about the big organizations controlling the funding. It's the individuals control the funding and they're making their purchases. So what it's really meant for Mabel is our vision was always people choosing people in communities everywhere within a safeguarded framework. But the people that are supplying those services for the first time can run their own small businesses in these sectors. They can be sole traders and incorporated small businesses. And that's powerful because small businesses are part of their local community. They know their community. They're often more flexible and responsive. They're more creative. They're highly motivated and they operate with lower overhead. So we see the fact that the reforms have occurred have not only allowed more choice and control for the people who need support, it's opened up opportunities for the people that offer support. And we're bringing in a whole new workforce of people locally. And one of the challenges in our sector is the growth in demand is really challenging workforce supply. There is a chronic workforce shortage, you know, that's been exacerbated by COVID. So opening up new workforce is really important.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, fascinating. And a lot of the listeners to this podcast are thinking about organization. And when we discuss that, I think a lot about how policy, both external policy or internal policy at organizations, how we can rethink that and flip these models, and how models, like you said before, you can have a system that almost is pushing down versus one that's empowering from the bottom and up. I can't help but think about organizations and how do we empower our employees, you know, move from entitlement to empowerment around choice and opportunity. And I think that's, we're going to see more of that in our workforce.
It really is shifting disability support from being a welfare model to one where people with a disability are a real asset for the economy, for society. And if we can support them and invest in them and give them the opportunity to live a more inclusive life, then there's not a cost to that. It's actually an investment that gets paid back. And it really is then empowering people with a disability to be included in all ways. And I think that's very much what you're talking about, that people move from entitlement to and move away from dependency and more towards empowerment.
And I know this is really important to you and the policy. How would you like to impact or shift governmental policy? You know, it sounds like there's more room to grow. When your time with Mabel is done, how would you like to have said that you've used this opportunity to impact larger policy?
So even though we've had major policy shifts in this country, I think it's important that government holds the course in terms of these reforms, right? Because it will take some time to bed down and to really sort of evidence the success. And I think that what we really want to influence is to show that people with a disability and older people have capacity to make decisions about their lives and the support they need. We should assume they have capacity. We should build their capacity and support them to make effective decisions as people that have agency in their lives. And sometimes when failures do occur, where there are poor outcomes, there can be a tendency for government to want to rush to regulation that's all about protecting people that are vulnerable. And a person with a disability that's, you know, also on our advisory committee and is well known in Australia has sort of made statements and opinion pieces around the fact saying, in the context of Royal Commissions, don't see me as vulnerable and rush to create regulation that keeps me safe, because that will just undermine my choice and control and undermine my quality of life. And so we want to continue to advocate for this movement of self-direction, self-management, choice and control. That's very consistent with human rights. It will deliver better outcomes. And we also want to support the movement towards flexible ways of working and to attract the workforce we need. And so that policy is still really opening up the rights for this shift to empowerment and defends the rights for shifts to empowerment.
I love it. And I've been really inspired. It's shedding a light on where we are in the States as well and where we have to go. So I've learned a lot through this. I've also learned a lot about how you're building this model for the workforce, for the people. And what I think is really interesting is that what it appears as it fits in that model of a gig workforce. And the whole gig economy has had both positive and negative perspectives, and we're seeing in different ways. I'd love to hear your approach to approach the gig economy with empathy and caring for workers. And even if there's some differentiation or ways we should think about different types of gig economies and how organizations can build this, because I think we're going to see more of it, but do it in a good way or a for purpose way.
Yeah, I think at the core is, I don't think Mabel has a long-term future if it's not improving outcomes for everyone that comes to the marketplace to engage, right? So we have to be just as much about how do we improve outcomes for people that offer support as much as people that need support. And certainly, I think I'm often sort of explaining to people that are trying to understand Mabel from a distance that sort of think, oh, you're a platform, you must be UberCare is a word that's often described. And it's shorthand for trying to think that every platform is a gig economy model. And I'm often, you know, saying to people, although we're a platform, we're not a gig model in the way you think about it. So often a lot of the concerns people have around some of the gig models that people sort of wonder about what the outcomes are for people that provide services via those platforms is often that the, you know, the platform is actually in control of the, you know, how people engage, allocating the jobs, setting rates, and that people supplying services to those platforms don't really have an avenue to advance themselves. And so there's some concern about the outcome to the side of the platform that's providing the service. You know, I think it's very different to a Mabel platform where we're not in the middle of the people engaging via Mabel, setting prices, setting terms, allocating jobs. We are about enabling people to come directly together and work it out together. And in fact, who's engaging via our platform? Somebody that needs support with somebody in their local community that can offer support. They are very capable of working things out together, particularly with putting safeguards around how people engage. And so what that means is people providing support via Mabel are just as empowered, have just as much choice and control, have just as much opportunity to build relationships with the other side of the platform. They're setting their own rates. There's no evidence of it being a race to the bottom. In fact, you know, which is often a criticism about gig models, just called a race to the bottom. If anything, it's a race to the top because the individuals who need support really value the people that provide support and they want them to be valued and well compensated. And as a platform, we're taking a lot of overhead out of the system and we're giving it back to the people engaging and saying, you can share the savings between yourselves. You can get more hours of support and you can also earn more and everyone can be better off. And so over time, you know, rates are rising about 6 to 7% year over year. So it's an entirely different model. And a lot of what we're really focused on is how do we improve outcomes for everyone, right? What can we do for the supply side of the marketplace and what can we do for people that are requiring the support?
It's great. It's so nice to hear a new perspective. I think so much of the attention around that gig economy, and like you said, a race to the top versus a race to the bottom, if we're not careful. And it also sounds like as those rates are going up, that's not by your doing. That is those rates are going up between the caregivers and the clients. They're making that decision.
No, that's exactly right. And when people say, where is the workforce going to come from to support our older population, to support people with a disability? We already have workforce shortages and we've got demand that's rapidly rising. I say the workforce is going to come from communities everywhere. There's people in communities all around Australia that will support somebody in their community if they can do it in a way where they're feeling valued, if they're feeling adequately rewarded, if it's flexible, if they're feeling empowered, and giving them a pathway to be a small business provider within their community is really opening up, you know, different opportunities. And in fact, you know, I see the workforce that's engaging by Mabel, they're like mini entrepreneurs, right? They are working out what is the set of services and support I can offer to people in my community that'll make a difference to their lives. That's exactly the sort of creativity and responsiveness you need, because support is fundamentally changing. It's not about support to live as it might have been in the past for a person with a disability. It's about support to live a life, and it's about support to therefore get involved in education, get involved in work, be a part of your community, pursue your passions. And so it requires a really diverse workforce to come into this sector, and so platforms like ours are really enabling that to happen.
One of the things that I noticed when speaking with Peter is that there's a deep joy and satisfaction in the work that he's doing. It's really refreshing to see a leader that's so connected to the empowerment of their customers, employees, and the people working through the Mabel platform. So I'm so curious to understand more about how he's thinking about diversity, equity, and inclusion as he builds his organization, particularly as the people Mabel serve would be some of the most diverse.
The community we serve is very, very diverse, right across people with a disability are very diverse. Older people are very diverse. The workforce we need on Mable is very diverse. And so at one level, one of the things we think about is, you know, we would like the team at Mable to reflect the community we serve, right? And that's sort of a bit of a vision state. And so we really want to be on a journey towards having an approach to diversity inclusion here that, that heads in that direction. So we've recently done our first diversity and inclusion survey. There was some really good baseline feedback from our team that, you know, 9% of people working here identify as having a disability. For example, 24% identify as having an immediate family member with a disability. I think 42% of them identify as having a caring role within the family. So there's some really interesting sort of baseline data, which I think says we're on the right track. I think there's room to continue to move. But interestingly enough, we got a lot of positive feedback. A high percentage of people were saying that you have an opportunity to succeed at Mable, no matter what your background is, that people feel confident to be able to, you know, really make a contribution at Mable, irrespective of the background and the voices heard. So I think that's a real positive. And what it's allowed us to do is sort of take that initial data and work with various teams about how we really intentionally build diversity and inclusion within the business. And I guess one of the silver linings in COVID is remote working, which has actually decreased the barriers to having a more diverse workforce, right? It's decreased the barriers to people with a disability feeling that they can equally participate as a member of the team at Mable. So that's giving us a real opportunity. And I think, you know, it's not only about diversity in terms of people with a disability, it's diversity in terms of older people as well, being able to have an opportunity to thrive at Mable. They're part of our community.
It's a great reminder. And I think there's been many gifts through this experience we've been through. And one is this idea of accessibility and how many people have been left out because of our old structures, and I'm hoping that we hold on to that. As you talk, I can't help but think, and I would love to just hear a little bit about your personal journey. I there's some projection here on my part, so correct me, but knowing you came up in the 80s and 90s in finance in New York City, which I don't imagine was embodying diversity and equity and inclusion, and your journey here today to what you're doing, any just reflections on that? I keep coming back to a little bit because it's so fascinating to me where you started your journey and what I imagine that was like and where we are today just as a society, or what we're seeing as an organizations and the kind of organization you're building. Anything you'd share there just for others on their journey into this and how to think about this?
You know, how would I reflect on that? Look, I grew up in the country, right? I'm a country kid. You know, my eyes opened up to the world through moving to Sydney to go to university. And after university, I did what a lot of people did, which is backpack around the world. That's a common trait in Australia. So I spent about a year and a half. And I remember thinking, you know, what I can give myself at the moment is time, right? I can give myself time to explore the world beyond what I've known. And so when I sort of started my work life, I guess I was just looking to start a career where I could learn and work in a way where I felt empowered to do good work. And I think, you know, the finance sector sort of offered that, and I didn't really understand it that well, but I was bringing a marketing lens to finance, right? It was really bringing a different point of view, and that's why they hired me. And I guess my lens in working in finance was always around understanding our customers and what our proposition can be, right? It was much more, so there might've been transactions happening on a trading floor, but I wasn't thinking about the transactions. I was thinking about the people that we served. And so that was probably a long part of my career. And one of the things, you know, I did want to do was experience time living overseas. So that sort of led me in that pathway. But then as you get older, I guess you become more self-reflective in terms of how you want to spend the rest of your life. You become maybe more aware of people who have different challenges in life. And when I saw the opportunities with the challenges my parents had, and I thought we could make a difference here, then when we launched that, it was people with a disability coming to the platform that opened my eyes to their lives and their challenges, right? It actually wasn't a personal journey for me at that stage. I'd had the experience of aging parents, and I could see my parents were developing, you know, functional decline and having real challenges in their life, but I hadn't had the personal experience of disability. But you know what? Our community was coming to Mable, bringing those personal stories, and it just sort of made you realize that there is a real need to make a difference in this area. And so that was, you know, what one of the things I think about is I think I listen and observe a lot, and you couldn't help but think we can bring our capabilities to bear here and change outcomes for people.
Yeah. And it sounds, from everything I can tell, you're having a major impact. And I, you know, hopefully also influencing in this podcast other leaders to think that way about listening to people and seeing them. And what you said about traveling, I mean, travel around your office or your organization, get to know people, understand what's going on in their lives. I think when we see people as humans, we compassion, empathy can build. Another thing, now I'm going to go back to organizationally because I'm so curious. I feel like your tools and what you're building in the world is really helping people find the accommodations and the support that they need in their lives. And I think there's this big movement, you know, we talk a lot about diversity in the workplace and, you know, neurodiversity or physical diversity, but I still think there's a lot of work to be done to support people to ask and to feel safe around asking for the support that they need. So the question here is around, is there anything that you've learned around building this platform, supporting people in the world to ask for the support and help them empower, feel empowered to ask for what they need and that sort of support, that we could bring back to share with employees around making it safer to look for support resources?
It's a great question. And certainly I think because our community includes people with a disability and we know finding opportunities for employment is a real need and a real challenge that's not being met. The National Disability Insurance Scheme is really focused on driving that outcome, but there's still so many barriers to actually making that a reality. But I think as an organization, it's made us really acutely aware of the need not only to support that, but to realize that diversity is a real strength, right? That people have different assets to bring to an organization. And if we're going to be as successful, we need to bring all that diversity and all of the strengths of that diversity into Mabel. And so there's probably some elements there which, you know, we're still trying to build on, right? It's not like we're perfect. We're still a small company scaling, working out how do we do this well. And so I think the first thing is trying to be really intentional about it, right? It's not going to happen by accident. It has to be intentional. So starting to understand, moving from just having a desire to be inclusive to, well, how are we doing in terms of inclusion, you know, in reality? What's our baseline of where we are today? And how can we then work with our team to actually put in place some tangible things that will make Mabel a place where people with different strengths can come in here and succeed and flourish? And part of that will be also led by the stories of success we ultimately have, right? I think it's important that we bring people into the company that are diverse, that they can succeed, and we can share those stories within the organization and outside the organization. Yeah. And interestingly enough, you know, we do lunch and learns, and we just did a lunch and learn with somebody that had a disability that is one of the more senior people in government that's actually an NDS participant and has had a really strong career commercially and within government. He was just talking about the barriers that still exist today for him, despite being successful, despite having senior roles. And he's saying, I face prejudice every day in a workplace. And how do other people that haven't yet had my success, you know, the level of prejudice they must have or barriers to success would be extreme. It starts with a real intention to do something about it and learn from people with disability, learn from people that are neurodiverse about how we can make it easier for them to succeed in our company.
Yeah. And you've mentioned a few times, and you know, about this idea of listening. I'm so happy you brought that up a couple of times, because I think it is about listening in conversations, but also how do we listen at scale and have metrics? Like you said, a recent podcast with our CEO Didier was just talking about, this is going to be hard work always. This is not, I'm going to cross the finish line and fix this. And I think part of that is being willing to look at those numbers and say, we have more to do. We have more to do. And you've talked about benchmarking and listening and just bringing data into that equation and really listening in the hard ways with hard facts and hard numbers and saying, this is going to be painful all the way through, but we have to keep at it.
Yeah. And recognizing we've still got a long way to go as Mabel. We still have an absolutely long way to go to be proud of the diversity inclusion we have in the workplace at Mabel. We're on a journey.
This season, we're talking to change makers and fire starters with the drive to do impactful and courageous work. Want to know if you're a fire starter too? Sprout has created an interactive quiz to help you discover where you are on your journey to drive big, impactful change. Explore Sprout's activation pack full of free tools and resources. Head to sprouta.com/activate.
something that came up too that's near and dear to my heart is community. And through that work of building community, I've really grown more and more aware that I think community is going to be a bigger, bigger component of successful organizations, our relationship with our clients, with the world. And I think it manifests via community in new ways. Yeah. How's Mabel thinking about that? How are you supporting or building community around the work that you're doing?
So when I've been asked, what is Mabel? I think of it as at three levels. One is that we're a technology company. We're building a platform to enable people connect and improve human services. But at another level, we're a community of people that gather around that marketplace to connect. And at a third level, I think we're part of a movement towards a self-direction, self-management, self-employment, people taking control. And I think of it as all three of those things. At our core, we're connecting people with people. But we're connecting people within communities, right? We have to provide local solutions. So in many respects, I think we're one platform that brings many communities together. And you can find community in different ways. It could be a small rural community. It could be a regional town. It could be a suburb of Sydney. But it could also be cultural communities like the Greek community, the Italian community. It can be LGBTQ communities. It can be Indigenous communities. So one of the things I really think about Mabel is we're one platform connecting many communities. And I think that we are very keen to foster this community-based approach. We think that's what will attract workforce to the sector is supporting people within my community, right? I think that's a cause that people can rally to. It's not being rostered to do tasks. It's actually relationship-based and community-based. And so we've been very much wanting to foster community around care and support. And we think that's an incredibly important part to the outcome for people that need support and attract workforce. And so we've had community engagement managers that have been on the ground talking to communities since we started and really trying to build this sense of community, a community that connects by Mabel. But similarly, there's examples where we've gone into small regional towns, you know, 500 people where there are no aged care services. It's not a big enough community. Those people are at risk of having to leave their community and go into residential aged care hundreds of kilometers away. And what we've really tried to take the approach is the community can build the solution and we can enable them to build that solution by bringing the platform in to connect people and to build their capacity. So people within the town can work with other residents to build a support solution and to build on the strengths of the community. One thing that we like to think is, how do we build on the strengths of that community versus, you know, solutions in the past might have been, oh, there's all these gaps. We have to bring them in from outside. We'd say, no, let's look at what strength lies within the community and how do we bring that community together to solve their challenges.
The word that just keeps, I've said it, and it just keeps coming up in our conversation for me is it just feels like there's so much empowerment that's happening on all different levels of really forcing people to question what's given to us, what we can provide for ourselves, and tools like yours, and you going into communities, empowering ourselves and learning that we do have more answers if we stop and we say we can solve this, and with some support, we can solve this. And that feels very empowering to me.
Yeah, and I think going back to what we talked about earlier, where when we sort of say, you know, government doesn't necessarily have the solution or non-for-profits don't have the solution, new thinking, leveraging tech is part of the answer. But what that's really doing is saying, people have the answer, right? Individuals and communities have the answer. And if we can just empower them to build their own solutions, that they can solve their challenges, right? We've in effect disempowered them and made them dependent with some of the old models, right? And this is almost like us saying, look, how do we co-design this together? We want to put people at the center of this. How do we solve these problems together? And let's work together to build something better.
I love it. I'm so inspired. One of the things we're doing this season is asking leaders, well, what's your question? So I'd love to know, you know, what is your question just in general, something you think a lot about when it comes to organization, culture, empowerment, and what's something that you think a lot about that you're digging into?
Look, I guess one of the things that's sort of top of mind for me is, you know, we've obviously gone through this pandemic, which has been incredibly traumatic in terms of loss of life and loss of health and loss of income and all of the emotional and mental anguish that people have experienced. But at the same time, there's been some silver linings around this, and to the extent that we've seen people become much more connected to their community, much more willing to support people within their community, much more connected to purpose, much more connected to impact, being much more self-reflective, we've seen changes to ways of working that have allowed greater inclusion for people that have potentially been excluded from work places. I think people have had much more opportunity to really focus on relationships in their life with family. They've had that time to perhaps have that cup of coffee with their spouse that they could never do in the morning, or, you know, spend time with their kids when they're doing their homework. They've been able to find more balance in their life. But I guess what we've been trying to understand is, as we potentially get back to normal or this new normal, how do we make sure we don't lose some of the positives that have come out of this, the sort of shifts in behaviors and values and sense of community and people willing to support each other to work differently, to work in more inclusive ways? I guess we would hate to see a shift back to something more normal lose some of what I think have been some of the silver linings to a terribly difficult time.
Yeah. How do we hold on? I love that question. And I think a lot about it myself. I think the piece I'm always coming up with is, how do we talk to each individual, not leave it to an organization to fix this for us, the government to fix this for us? I think everything has shadow and light, right? And there's a lot of shadow and darkness to this, but there was what you hit on, a lot of light. And historically, we've heard that. I mean, I've read a lot of research around, in times of war, how people say it was awful, but we really love the camaraderie and like how we came together. And my want for people is just to stop and reflect, as much as we all want this to be over, what did you really enjoy and what are you going to do to hold on? And if every individual just takes a moment to be thinking about that, I know time with my children that I never would have had. I was traveling and, you know, what a gift. My children are 10 and 13. I mean, the final piece around organizations is, I believe that there were so many things that we've talked about, at least in the culture world, around changing and shifting. And I think inertia is a very powerful mechanism. And we've had this opportunity where the handbrake was pulled, and it probably only happened once in our lifetimes. And we're going to start letting go of it and coming back. And just to every person saying, you know, if you just expect it, it's just going to bounce back to something better or new, it won't. We all have to fight for that, to build our organizations differently, to hold our leaders accountable, to change the structures. And there's just, I feel like there's a moment right now to do that. And for me, it's through the Culture First community, or this call to act and say, be the change. Don't just want it, but be the change that you want to see in the world. So that's my take on that. I mean, I'd love to hear others. So
yeah, look, I think it's a profound time we've all lived through, and we all get to shape how we come out of it, right? So
yeah,
let's try and hold on to the positive aspects of this in terms of the way people engage with community and the relationships around them.
We have the answers, right? I mean, that's come out of this today, is that the collective, we have the answers if we trust ourselves and we empower ourselves. So
yeah, no, I agree.
Peter, this has been such an honor, and I've been inspired by your work, getting to know more about Mabel and just your journey and career, and saying, I mean, talk about be the change. You saw something that you struggled with, which clearly many people struggled with, and you leaned into it to create something different, and on a policy level, an organizational level, at a community level. So I just thank you for your work, and thank you for taking the time to share that with us. And I look forward to, and everybody here at Sprouta, just sharing your work and your message with our world. So thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And look, what Mabel's become today wouldn't have happened with lots of other people being willing to lean in and drive change as well, right? Being so educated by many of the people that I've met along this journey about what's important, and many people are wanting to drive change. And so it's certainly, I think where Mabel is today is a credit to the community that have joined us in a drive for change, right? It's not us alone. It's everyone that's willing to do things differently, willing to take a chance to do things differently, and has jumped right in with us. So certainly a collective effort.
I look forward to seeing where this goes, and I'll definitely keep an eye out. So thank you, Peter.
My pleasure. Thanks, Craig, for the conversation.
Hi, I'm Leonie.
And I'm Marcus, and we're the founders of Sprouta.
Sprouta is a global ecosystem of experts and solution providers who can help you solve your most complex challenges in people, performance, and culture.
We know change isn't always easy. We want to offer you a 30-minute discovery course so you can share some of your challenges, ideas, and insights.
We create a safe and productive thinking space to help you gain clarity, identify priorities, and plan your next steps.
So let's start a conversation. Head to sprouta.com.